From WWNO, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. This and every week, we talk to people in Louisiana who've devoted their lives to music. We want to hear about their experiences and listen to what they're listening to, because that's where our music comes from. This week, the alpha male of the New Orleans sound, Alan Toussaint.
Most of my life was spent in the studio waiting for the red light. And that's my comfort zone, and that's what I've been doing since I was a teenager. Katrina came along and was quite a booking agent. For one thing, it sent us all scattered here and there, and it was even martial law. We had to leave home.
Composer, arranger, producer, performer, and traveling man, Alan Toussaint, this week on Music Inside Out. First, the news. In New Orleans, most people have a different sense of direction than the rest of the world. You're either headed to the lake side of something or the riverside. The West Bank is more of a guess than an actual direction, especially when you see the sun set on the opposite side of the river. For most music lovers, getting from here to there is a little more straightforward, because nearly all creative roads lead through one man. Anyone who has turned on a radio in the past 50 years knows that in New Orleans, the musical equivalent of North, South, East, and West is Alan Toussaint. He's written, produced, and arranged what we've come to know as the New Orleans sound. But Alan Toussaint spills over the city limits and rambles across the entire landscape of music. Jazz, Americana, funk, rhythm and blues, classical. His collaborations with other artists are legend, and now he's touring more than ever. But no matter where you find Alan Toussaint, he always brings you home. Speaking of which, we're joining him at his house in New Orleans. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to have you.
You've always been a live performer, but now you're doing it more and more. It used to be that we would expect you at a jazz festival. You were the center square, so to speak, on the Acura stage. Everything either happens before Alan Toussaint or after Alan Toussaint. But can you talk a little bit about why you have been touring in the last few years more and more?
Well, before Katrina, most of my life was spent in the studio waiting for the red light. And that's my comfort zone, and that's what I've been doing since I was a teenager. And I would perform only very sparingly a couple of times a year. Katrina came along and was quite a booking agent. For one thing, it sent us all scattered here and there, and it was even martial law. We had to leave home.
It's a New Orleans. New Orleans thing. It doesn't leave you just because you leave town. Now, we got our own kind of thing. It's a New Orleans thing. It's a New Orleans.
Doing benefits and collaborations with folk, the aftermath of Katrina, which caused me to perform more than usual. So that sort of started this new surge of live performances. I found it quite rewarding, however, even though I was uncomfortable at first, because I just never felt like a front stage center person, for one thing. I'm a behind-the-scenes person very comfortably. So I like to prepare things, write the songs, arrange, and prepare for artists who love to be front stage center. So I'm used to sending my wares out there rather than to take them out there.
Mother, mother, just look what they done to your son. Mother, mother, a song I wrote for Dr. John. I have felt the mark of 10,000 teeth. I done seen my body lying stiffly at my feet. As I see my soul creeping out of my chest, I I bow my head towards the east, but victim by the west. Mother, mother, just look what they done to your son.
But Katrina changed that for a season. And I found it quite rewarding because in the studio when we're performing and waiting for the red light, the ultimate aim is to get to people.
Yes.
To get to them and to get to their hearts. And when you're on stage and the audience is right there, that is the meat of the matter. That is what it's all about. So that's why I found it so rewarding and it's been good for me to get out and perform live. The feedback from the audience, there's nothing like it. That's why some folk can't quit, don't care how old they get.
How or where are you of the audience as you're performing?
Well, I must say that I was so surprised that as many people knew who I was, because being behind the scenes, I didn't expect to be known at all, and that's fine with me because it's what I do. But I found that there were many people who knew about my history and the things that I've done and written and arranged and produced. So I found that a bit comfortable.
He's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's a member of the Songwriters Hall of Fame. This year he received the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. He's produced, written, arranged, composed, played, and sang an entire world of New Orleans music.
I must say I didn't know what to do for them, because who am I up here? I'm not the guy who had this last hit record or that hit record or whatever. That's my thing. I'm the guy who wrote songs, who was made popular by so-and-so.
Would you mind if I made a request?
Yes, though I don't consider you an audience or a member thereof. But in a way, I guess we can say that.
I am a representative of the audience.
Okay.
You see, that's it.
Thank you.
But this is a request from your Bright Mississippi album, which was an album. This is one of your latest albums, I should say. And
yes,
in it, you take on Ellington. You take on Jelly Roll Morton and Louis Armstrong and Django Reinhardt, you know, who is also just delightful. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a request, but I'm going to give you the choice, because I have three
sure
that I would be perfectly happy hearing. One would be Wine and Boy Blues. That is the Jelly Roll Morton tune. There's also Blue Drag by Django Reinhardt, or, of course, Ellington and Solitude.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yes.
Thank you. Bless you. Bless you, man. That was really beautiful. Really beautiful. Even though you are, you know, a son of this area and embody New Orleans' musical cultural heritage, in many ways, I associate you not with Louis Armstrong, but more with a Duke Ellington, someone who is creatively restless, someone who who throughout his career worked with lots of different amalgamations of artists, from large groups to small ensembles to duets. And in the latter stages of his career, what he did was he took to the road more often. I'm not suggesting that you're in the latter stage of your career, but what I am suggesting is that he wanted to hear his music in the world around him. Do you see any similarity between you and Ellington in this regard?
Well, I'd love to see some similarity in any regard with such a giant, a gentle giant, and a classy, superb individual. I must say, he more readily took his music to the site than most of my career. I've sent mine.
It's true, and with Ellington, I mean, this is a fellow who also spent a great deal of time on collaborations, you know, with Johnny Hodges, with Ella Fitzgerald, for instance, and of course, the greatest collaboration of all, which was, you know, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, which is, of course, probably my favorite album of all time.
Yes.
So there's something, you know, that that clicks in terms of relating you to this, as you say, this gentle giant who also, you know, sat at the piano and spent a lot more time alone than most people ever gave him credit for.
That comes every now and then in the whole history of the world. Every now and then there's such as Einstein, Duke Ellington, et cetera.
And some would say Alan Toussaint.
Thank you.
More in a minute with the great Alan Toussaint. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We're at Alan Toussaint's home studio, and we never want to leave.
You know, back in 1972, you did an album called Life, Love, Faith, in which you sang a number of your own, well, all of your own songs, but songs that, to the audience, were more easily identifiable with the artist who originally sang those songs.
Sure.
You know, but you do a heck of a version of On Your Way Down as a vocalist.
Sunrise and sunset, since the beginning, it hasn't changed yet. Some people fly high, begin to lose sight. It's horrible. You can't see very clear when you're in flight. It's high time.
I remember where I was when I wrote it. I was out in the parking lot at Mason's. We used to hang out in the parking lot. In fact, it was the same time I wrote Night People, because I used to see Night People coming, hanging out, looking at each other, waiting for something to happen. Every time the door swung open, everyone looked to see who's coming in. Couldn't help but write Night People. If I wouldn't have written it, it would have written me. But On Your Way Down, I was thinking about people, how some people handle each other. And it seemed to be, don't care how hip you are, how whatever you are, there's such as karma, something that happens. Like a person who, like, I don't think you can really go broke being charitable to people. I think you'll always be rewarded back. And I think if you're doing bad things, don't care how tough you are and how protected you are, something to make its way around to you that'll sort of balance that scale out.
You think the sun rises and set for you, but the same sun rises and set and shine on the purple too. I don't mind.
Hey, goodbye.
I remember reading some years ago in The New Yorker, Paul McCartney gave an interview, and he said, whenever I feel really down, I start thinking about some of the songs that I've written, and I feel good about myself again. For instance, he says, he said, I remember that I was the guy who wrote Paperback Writer, and I was the guy who wrote Yesterday, so I can't be all bad.
Paperback Writer.
Are there any particular lyrics that you look back on today and you think, I wrote that? That's pretty good.
Well, if I had written the songs you just mentioned that he wrote, I would feel like him. He is a marvelous writer. I just think that's one of the great things that has happened in the whole history of songwriting. There are songs that I like, and there's some that I wonder who sneaked in and wrote that little crappy song. However, it was a hit. There's some that I feel better than others, and there's some that I feel good about for other reasons. Like there's a song I wrote called Transition, which no one knows but me. And I wrote it for Lou Johnson. It was one of those times when when you write a little beyond yourself at the moment. Maybe later on you grow up to it, but at the moment you sort of wrote beyond yourself. And I like that piece because of that. It seems like it's better than I am.
Wow.
And maybe I hope I've caught up with it by now, but I know it was better than I was then. And some songs that are really inspired, and you do some just because you know how to write. After a while, you have enough things in your toolbox. So if you need a song right now, if you need one about you, I can look at you and write a song about you now.
Really?
Yes, and from the way you sound as wonderful as you speak, I would have to put some good vernacular in it as well. If you spoke a little like James Brown, it would sound differently. So you can write just because you have tools in your box, and you can write sometimes from inspiration, which you'd rather. But you can't always wait for that because it's time to write now and the artist is on the way. But I love to write when I'm inspired because it's like you have a collaborator that you can't see, and you feel like you're just a medium for it. Southern Night is a song that is about my childhood from 6 years old. I go and visit old folk in the country who spoke Creole, and and they, it was another way of life, and things were quite different, and the world was quieter, and nights were darker. And I remember writing that, and it felt like a soft cloud came over me, because I remember closing my eyes. I remember the moment, and it was like a soft cloud came over me, and I felt I was being hugged. And as that song began to develop, I just wrote what it told me to write. Every now and then that happened. I guess it happened to all songwriters, and it's happened to me a few times, only a very few times. I would like it to always be that way. I'd like the clouds to open and say, here, because I'm lazy as anyone else. But that's the general process. Those are the processes that I write under.
It's true, and that particular song, your rendition of that song, is so deeply atmospheric. You know, the distance of your voice, you know, as you're singing, as a listener, I feel those nights, you know, and those nights in the country with my people, for instance. And there's something about, I think, your ability to incorporate memory into your songwriting. Because that's what that song is about. That's what Tipitina and Me is about. You know what I mean? Extremely atmospheric, almost sensory memory, you know, that sometimes needs a lyric, sometimes doesn't.
Yes, yes, yes.
So does the mood fall upon you, or do you wake up with it, or as you're brushing your teeth or cutting up onions, or what is it that, how does that medium come to you?
Everything except the onion. I hate onions and garlic.
Do but, you?
Yes, I don't touch them. I don't come anywhere near them. But anyway, that cloud with Southern Nights was a very light cloud. It wasn't full of thunder and stuff. But atmospheres are very, very important. I make notes all the time. Every day I do what I do, in one way or another. I'm either finishing something or throwing something away that I thought was wonderful yesterday and thought I was crazy today. But I make notes a lot, and atmospheres has everything to do with it. For instance, Southern Nights, I sung through a Leslie speaker.
Okay.
With the spinner going around, because I needed to lift it above my normal tempo here. And it needed to float, and it needed to be above in that world and among the trees and the breezes and things like that. So that was as important to me as whatever the words are, because the words, to me, dictated that needed to say, the story does. And other things, when I make notes about different places and cities that I go, I always write down how I felt about it and at that moment. Because after a while, it's just words, and you know it's a plot. But I needed to know how I felt about it. I remember one time being in San Diego, and it was a Sunday, and it looked like San Diego was closed. But it wasn't, and there was a mall down the street. And I got out the hotel, and I was walking down, and I was walking to a red light at the corner, and I had to wait there. And I looked around, there was a couple walking slowly back here. And they stopped because the red light was there, but they didn't come all the way to the corner. They stopped and kissed. And I thought, oh, how wonderful this is. So, of course, I began taking my notes, and I remember saying how I felt about what I saw there, because it was how they felt that that needed to happen, and where I was, this is what was happening at this moment. Whatever was going on in the world, this is the only thing that exists right now.
I love the way you love to live. You love life. Your inspiration. I love the way that you give your heart so freely. You're a sweet sensation. You're my invitation to happiness. You're full of sweet surprises, happiness. You fill my heart desire more, 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 and more.
But you know, one of the songs that I actually, I have to say, every time I put on your records, I have to hear is, believe it or not, Brickyard Blues.
Well.
Yes, because it to me, you perfectly cast a conversation between a musician and a paramour, or a potential paramour, I should say, in the sense that, you know, there's something in the vernacular that works. When the person says, play something I can understand, play me those Brickyard Blues, something sweet, something mellow, something I can sink my teeth in just like Jell-O. I mean, this is, I don't know why, but I just, it reminds me of innocence and lust and humor, which is extremely atmospheric.
You just busted me. I thought I was cool.
I think I'm grinning like a monkey now, right? How did that line come to you?
Well, it's easy. Look at the monkey.
Well, I tried to run my game. She said, man, that's the same old thing I've heard before. And I'm too tired to go by your show. Yeah.
talking with Alan Toussaint this week. Still to come, Alan and Elvis, Sitting in a Tree, S-I-N-G-I-N-G. Are you following us on Twitter? We're Music Inside Out, and look for us on Facebook as well. Back with Alan Toussaint in a minute. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and we're talking with Alan Toussaint.
Not a soul was stirring, not a bird was singing, at least not within my hearing. I was 5 minutes past caring, standing in the road just staring.
You have this special relationship with Elvis Costello, and you guys have been in orbiting one another for, I don't know, since the early 80s, I would think, or the mid 80s. In fact, I knew in my dorm room, listening to Elvis Costello's album, Punch the Clock, that he would one day work with you. He did this song called Every Day I Write the Book, which was a response to Who Wrote the Book of Love. And it's brilliant. And I remember in my dorm room thinking, this sounds like an Alan Toussaint production. And shortly thereafter, you guys connected. I think I'm prescient.
I think I would like to interview you. Good heavens.
She hasn't been gone long enough for me to miss her. Except for every minute of every hour of every day when I wish I could possess her. 40 days pass by. 40 alibis, so carry on that way, and in time you pay, but we'll all be together come Ascension Day. Not a leaf was hanging on the tree like when it started, but I know they will return like they've never gone away come Ascension Day.
Why do you guys get along so well? How do you see it?
Well, Elvis, it's a luxury to be with him. I have never met anyone who carries as much around as Elvis Costello and who has as much respect and love for all genres. You drop him off on Planet Music, not one or the other. It could be bluegrass. It could be gut bucket blues.
Could be big band.
Yes, it could be classical, chamber orchestra. It could be ballet. And he could host The Tonight Show.
Yes.
The man is just, and he could talk about arts and paintings and books. And for his recordings, he don't know only the A sides and what was on the other sides. He knew the other sides that didn't make it to the press. Good heavens, man. And artists who wanted to be something and never got there, he knows some of their songs. He knows Curly Moe.
Wow.
Such a wealth of information, and he shares that wealth readily. When in collaborating with him and working with him, whether it be sidemen or artists, he shares the wealth with everyone. When we were out in concert with the full array of musicians we had on the recording session, which we traveled with, we weren't out there but two or three days when it was time to announce these musicians. He could announce everyone,
wow,
their names and where they were from and give them their accolades and all. It just, he's a tremendous man. There's not many people like him. All that talent was given to the right person because he shares it so freely.
Yeah. You know, back in the mid-80s, I was in the French Quarter, and I ran into this very tall, dark-haired British guy. And we introduced ourselves, and he said, my name is Pete Thomas, and I play drums for Elvis Costello and the Attractions. And he says, and we're here because we're in New Orleans because Elvis is working with Alan Toussaint on a Yoko Ono project.
Walking on thin ice.
Exactly. Yes. And he said, there's something, he goes, you know, Elvis is he can be a touchy guy. This is what he said. This is not me. He said, Elvis can be a touchy guy. He goes, but there's something about the way Alan Toussaint approaches Elvis that works. And he said the first time that he saw you meet, you got out of your car, opened the trunk, and had like hot plates of food covered in Reynolds wrap. And he says, and the first thing you said to Elvis was, "Can you help me with this?"
Sure.
Which Pete Thomas saw as brilliant, like a brilliant move to sort of disarm the situation, to kind of like create a situation where you guys are just guys who are bringing some food into a room together.
Oh, yes.
Do you think about these meetings, you know, with another artist, someone like an Elvis Costello, someone who's, you know what I mean, who's got this great track record and, you know, you're trying to make music together and you got to, you know, break the ice. Do you think about these meetings?
No. No thought at all.
Wow. There's a, particularly on the song Ascension Day, there's a lot of emotion in that song that comes from Elvis Costello's vocal, but also comes from your piano play. The piano play to that song is the song that we have come to know as Tipitina and Me, or very similar. Those minor chords, you know.
Yes, yes.
That song, it just, it's so, I don't know, stirring.
Well, it come from, of course, Professor Longhair, because I am a disciple of Professor Longhair. Yes, Professor Longhair and then the rest of us. Most of those words were written by Elvis himself.
Really?
Yes. And he'd asked my opinion about this, that, and the other, and attribute to whatever I said about this section or that section. But that was his idea to say those things. And I just thought it was delightful. And that's how that went. Before we get to the actual song of Tipitina, which is an actual song, we play an intro that's in the style of Professor Longhair, but not... the song yet, and I played a melodic line within that. And then. So that's what Elvis was singing. That is the beginning of that song. And later on in the song, we get to, which is actually Tipitina.
That that song has what you would call the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost in it. You know, the Father being Professor Longhair.
Yes.
The Son being you.
Okay.
The Holy Ghost being Elvis, you know.
Yes, thank you.
It's gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. Is there, I mean, I almost always break into tears when I hear that song. Although it's not necessarily a sad song, you know. Are there sad notes? Are there sad chords?
Yes. Well, minor modes, if done generally in their mode, gives a sadness, and majors usually give a gladness, a stately feeling. For instance, if you hear this chord, that seemed kind of sad. And if you hear it, seemed like, oh, we're going to be all right after all. And the sound, oh, I'm not sure. Oh, it's okay. Yes, they're all sad chords, and then there are some tension chords somewhere in the middle. But then it's going to be all right. Back to sadness. Yes, there are sad things, and there are uplifting things. Sound like it's going somewhere up there, and you had better go, or else you can't just stay there forever.
Right. In anticipation.
Yes, yes. It's on the way somewhere.
And so are there any notes that you would call your, I don't know how to describe it, almost like your red phone note, the note that you, or chord that you don't play very often, and when you do, you really mean it?
No, well, there's something, oh yes, well, for one thing, in the conventional music we play, we rarely ever use an augment 11. Those are those Duke Ellington chords. But augment 11 chords. Yes, that's some of that.
What does that say to you, that chord?
That's a sophisticated jazz. Yes. So you better know what you're doing. It's like carrying your own pool stick, you know? Oh, yes. Oh, like your name that. On your bowling ball. You know?
That's right. That's right. You got a claim. All right. Do you feel like you talk better on the piano?
Oh, yes. 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 Though I wouldn't dare do it now, but in my set, and I said, in all honesty, I said I had begun to be interviewed after Katrina, and being from New Orleans and with my degrees, or the anti-degrees of edumacation, I would rather not speak too long for any length of time, because then you begin to hear all the grammatical misfits and my how I coincide with Einstein. He split atoms, I split verbs. So I came up with a musical way of saying where I'm from an early childhood. I came up from there all the way to today. So yes, I think that I can do that, and I feel it describes me better than if I was trying to give you a chronological report audibly with my words.
So we've come to the end of our time together, and I wanted to thank you so much for being with us and having us in your studio. And I also wanted to make one last audience request, but it's going to be one hopefully that you can accommodate, which is play any song you want. Anything you want.
Yeah. Oh, good heaven, any song I want. I had a cousin named Dolores. She was a very fine girl, much older than I. And she had a boyfriend named Sammy. And he used to come over and he played a little simple It's called Dolores Boyfriend. I was 9 when she used to come. He used to come by and he'd play that.
That was Sammy's girlfriend's cousin, Alan Toussaint, speaking with us from his home in New Orleans. Next week, a choir boy goes rogue.
My mother wouldn't let us hear that rock and roll. She said, "Oh, no, turn that stuff off." She said, "She heard Shirley and Lee." She said, "Ooh, that woman sound like a cat on a hot tin roof."
Deacon John, the prodigal son of New Orleans music. Don't forget to check out our website at WWNO.org. You'll find today's playlist there and music streams of all our shows if you need to catch up. This is Music Inside Out. Each week we feature the people of Louisiana who've devoted their lives to making the music we call our own. Their experiences and influences are where our music comes from. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Jason Rhine, and Sean Collins. The theme song was composed and performed by James Booker. Jason Saul keeps the WWNO website so nice. Ron Curtis is the station's operations manager. Ron Biava is WWNO's marketing and development manager. And the general manager of WWNO is Paul Mawson. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.